The title is Critical Theory in the Gospel, Understanding and Engaging Critical Theory. This is a summary of a manuscript I've finished. For time constraints and to not try to do too much, I've restricted it to just the guts, the theological, philosophical guts of the issue. When I say critical theory, I'm not speaking of the race stuff. There is a chapter where I draw some links between the older critical theory of the 1920s Germany, we'll do some history in a second, and some contemporary discussion about race. But if you came for a talk on critical race theory, this isn't that talk. This is a bit different. By way of introduction, before COVID, before the summer of 20, before the death of George Floyd, I was already developing interest in so-called critical theory, sometimes called cultural Marxism. In certain circles, that term is quite sensitive. So I decided to title my book Critical Theory, even though the critical theorists at times are happy to call themselves cultural Marxists. They're not as reticent about the phrase as maybe some critics are, but I've chosen to speak of critical theory. I want to spend a few minutes introducing it. When I speak of critical theory, I'm talking about the 1920s, 1930s, largely Jewish Marxist in Frankfurt, Germany, called the Frankfurt School. It's a political, social, intellectual group. These are high-powered scholars. These are not lightweights. It takes a lot of time. It took me a lot of time to wade through at least a significant amount of primary source material, trying to understand what in the world is going on. I'll circle back to this, but they were Marxists, but frustrated Marxists, and we'll talk about why they were frustrated. In the book, I chose to comment on four key figures, and these are all first-generation critical theorists. So, Theodor Adorno, you can see his years here. Again, very difficult to read, but it is worth reading him, sometimes more easier than another time, but very turgid. Max Horkheimer, who served as not the first, but the second, almost the first, director of the Institute for Social Research. We'll talk about that in a second. Walter Benjamin, to me, one of the most interesting of the critical theorists. His mind was all over the place. Also, all these guys are Jewish, and in trying to escape the Nazis, it's a sad story. He and his family are moving across west trying to escape Nazism. And he goes to bed, or is preparing for bed, thinking he won't make it out in the morning. It appears that he committed suicide with a drug overdose. So a sad story. Then Herbert Marcuse. And I've decided to focus my comments particularly on Marcuse for a number of reasons. He's the link between the early critical theorists of the 1920s, 30s, and today, the line can be most clearly drawn from Marcuse, almost word for word, concept for concept. And he's also, I'm not trying to be provocative, the most centered on sex. And so we are Christians, and we have there are ladies present, so I won't be unduly inappropriate or graphic, but highly sexualized, as you will see. Is it a worldview? Is it a philosophy? Is it a political system agenda? It's probably all of that. I'm going to suggest it's a kind of theology. I'm kind of trading on the word theology there, but it's a kind of theology. But a word on the word critical. As Christians, we're happy to use that word. We're happy to, like the word radical comes from the word radix, meaning root. We do want to get to the root of the matter. We do want to be critical in the best sense of that term. What I want to suggest throughout the talk is that in one sense, an irony is the critical theorists aren't critical enough. I'll try to make that case. They don't get to the heart of the matter as I see it. I think to get to the heart of the matter requires a Christian view of reality, and I'll try to make that clear in the few minutes I have. But let's do look at a brief history to kind of set the stage a bit before we engage its the world of ideas. Again, the critical theorist, again, generally Jewish Marxists, they start the Institute for Social Research in Frankfurt, Germany. As Nazism begins to rise in the 30s, many of them, the center or the institute, and many of the participants relocate to New York, University of Columbia, and some go to California. So you'll find Marcuse and others off at Californian universities working and writing, et cetera. What's animating them is they are Marxists, but confused Marxists. And so they've seen the revolution in Russia, but they are deeply existentially puzzled, maddened, confused by why there hasn't been a concomitant revolution elsewhere, particularly their own Germany. And I do a little more of this in the book. I'm condensing it here. And much has been written on this about in Germany, why didn't Marxism have the revolution that the theorist thought it should have? And this existential angst only intensified. You've had World War I by the time the critical theorists begin to do their thing. World War II just kind of heightens the matter. If you have two world wars, and that's not enough to bring about the revolution, what in the world could it be? Could there be? And so they are frustrated Marxists. And so one of the reasons they're often called cultural Marxists is these Marxists at least decide there's got to be something besides the economy. There's got to be something besides money that's driving this. Why is the middle-aged European couple with 2.5 children and a middle, you know, income job, and they've got some entertainment and pizza and food, you know, they're pretty okay. Why do they not rise up and throw off their shackles, as the critical theorist, as Marxist, would see all these people existing in shackles? And they begin to say there must be something else, and that something else is largely going to be cultural issues. And we'll talk a bit about that. Here's what Stuart Jeffries. If you want to buy my book, you can. But if you want to buy another book, Stuart Jeffries' book, Grand Hotel Abyss, is I found the most helpful one-volume treatment, and written from a very sympathetic perspective to the critical theorist. He writes this. The Frankfurt School sought to understand, quote, what it was about capitalism's oppressed people, that stopped them rising up to the end, to end their bondage, to be delighted rather with the very chains that bound them. Okay, so there's an oppressed people. They don't realize they're oppressed. So maybe there's something besides the economy that's an issue here. There's a certain understanding of freedom here. And certainly as Christians, we want to have a Christian theology of freedom and thinking in biblical Christian categories. But here's Horkheimer. The goal of critical theory is to protect, preserve, and where possible, extend the limited and ephemeral freedom of the individual. There is a kind of individual, even though it's Marxist, it's collectivist in another sense, there's a kind of individualism at play here as well. So people like Duiverd and Van Til could speak about this, where non-Christian worldviews or non-Christian philosophies often tend to oscillate between poles, so individualism and collectivism. And there's this instability built into non-Christian worldviews and a constant oscillation back and forth. I won't do a lot more with that, but I do a bit of that in the book. So again, the Marxists are trying to rework their Marxism. I've already given you the Stuart Jeffries quote. And to grasp critical theory, you somehow have to be able to hold together that freedom is the goal in a certain sense, and we'll linger on Marcuse on this, but yet capitalism is also the enemy. So if you're at least a Westerner of some sort, you might associate free market capitalism with freedom. That wasn't a part of the critical theorist worldview. Capitalism is a part of the chief oppressor of people, even if the people in a capitalist system don't see themselves as oppressed. And if one can grasp that, one can grasp why, for someone like me, still in my 50s for a few more months. Now, my children all still love us. Is that right, children? You like us? Okay. But if you're wondering why some of us at our generation, the children might see us as hopelessly Neanderthal and is caught in our oppression even, right? I've heard these conversations where the children might say, you're a part of an oppressor class, right? You're a part of a, and you yourself are oppressed. You just don't know it, mom and dad, right? So I'll try to explicate that as we go. A part of the critical theorists, they're asking this question. What is wrong? What has gone wrong with the 20th century? And this is an important book, Adorno and Horkheimer. If you want to read one book besides Marcuse, Adorno and Horkheimer's Dialectic of Enlightenment. I read it word for word, very slowly. So sorry, Diane, for those late nights tucked away trying to finish it. I've got notes on that. I'm happy to send anyone who wants my notes on the book. But it's interesting because here's one quote. They said, what we had set out to do was nothing less to explain why humanity, instead of entering a truly human state, is sinking into a new kind of barbarism. So the early critical, if you think of critical theorists as simply black mass Antifa on the streets of Seattle, Chicago, I don't know the scene in Europe as well. There's a difference here. There's similarities and differences. The critical theorist in their own way wanted to say, what has gone wrong with the 20th century? Why all this kind of barbarism? In their own way, asking, why is Western culture disintegrating? Now, their answer wouldn't be a traditional conservative answer, but they are asking, where has this barbarism come from, and what can we do to reduce this? Okay? And I only mention this briefly, but there's also a concern for popular culture and the influence of technology. So if I were to give you a headline, Think Tank is concerned about the influence of pop culture and iPhones and technology on the youth of today, you might think it was going to be from a more traditional-minded kind of think tank, right? But the critical theorists have this concern as well. Their concern's different, but their concern is it's not just the economy, stupid. It's not just money. It's not just economics. But the youth of today, young persons, all persons ultimately, are so affected by pop culture, what Adorno and Horkheimer could call the culture industry, that they're also blind to being oppressed, right? They're also blind. Now, you and I as Christians might have similar but dissimilar concern, right? That our children or the youth in our churches or whatever are so plugged into the technology, they're being unduly influenced. Horkheimer and Adorno thought something similar, but their concern was that the culture industry would keep particularly young people from grasping that they're oppressed by the capitalist system, and they must come awake and recognize their own oppressed state. So what I want to do is just a fun quote from Chesterton: "All revolutions are doctrinal." found that after I'd finished the manuscript. Oh, I thought, what a great quote to put at the front of the book. But all revolutions are doctrinal. And I want to suggest something like that. I want to suggest, for the purposes of this presentation, critical theory will be analyzed as a kind of alternative theology or religious system. Or critical theory will be analyzed as a kind of system fundamentally religious, which is parasitic on Christianity. I'm not going to say the critical theorists get all the questions right and just get the answers wrong. I think that's a bit of a facile approach. I'm not criticizing anyone in particular, but just a general line you sometimes hear. I want to suggest the critical theorists certainly get the answers wrong, but they're also confused on the questions. They also get the very, very basic questions wrong in a fundamental sense. So I want to suggest that the critical theorists, and here's the guts of the book really, is that they've got their own sense of creation and reality, or their own kind of metaphysic, we might say. I'm not saying the critical theorist lingered on Genesis or whatever, but they have their own sense of what is the world. They have their own sense of what is wrong with the world, and they have their own sense of redemption. And at a number of places, not uncommonly, using explicitly redemptive language and the need of a new man, a new reality principle. Walter Benjamin can even talk of the need of a messianic rupture to break into history and to make things right. I mean, it's quite striking, Benjamin. And so I will concentrate for this talk more on redemption than this part of the material which is in the book. But let's jump in then. So on the question of creation and reality. So ostensibly the critical theorists reject metaphysics. I want to suggest there is a kind of metaphysics there. They claim to reject a telos or a goal, but there's very much their own goal, particularly Marcuse. It's not Aristotle, it's not the Bible, it's not Augustine, but there's certainly a goal. There's certainly a transformed new man. Literally, they want to change the world, without a doubt. Here's also, civilization and work are hostile to or antithetical to the nature of man. And so if we're thinking like Christians already, we're thinking, I smell a rat, right? Civilization is bad. Work is bad. And so we think of, my family is here. For good or for ill, I've shaped them. Okay, Diane, I've shaped them. And Marcuse, and I have Marcuse in my head, but the critical theorist in general, would say we must liberate children from the influence of their parents, particularly traditional parents, and particularly Christian parents. And if you were here and you believe in inerrancy and you're a complementarian, you're just the worst of the worst, right? That's really oppressive. As Marcuse would say, you're in a category all by yourself. Okay. And so we'll linger on that as we go. Now, one of the most important principles for Marcuse is what he has to say about the reality principle and the pleasure principle. Let me introduce it now, and we'll say a bit more as we go. Marcuse does this in his book, Eros and Civilization. And if you want to read one book besides Adorno, Horkheimer, this might be the one book of primary sources you might read to grasp. Marcuse, his system, and the current sexual situation, sexual ethical situation, really in all of Western culture, as far as I know. In short, here's what Marcuse argues following Freud. There's two principles, the reality principle and the pleasure principle. The reality principle is things like order, work, self-discipline, behaving sexually. It's better just to have you and your husband and wife and you all engage in your relationships. that's not our true heart. That's not our true desire. That's not this principle. But the reality principle is, if you want order, society, sanity, stability, you've got to follow the rules of the reality principle. The pleasure principle is the principle that's our deepest, that's our truer self. And where you and I as Christians might say, yes, every human heart has a perversion in it and is must resist temptation, etc. None of us would say as Christians that that's who we're meant to be, right? Or that's who we ought to be, right? But Marcuse particularly says, no, the following Freud, the pleasure principle, largely sexual pleasure, is in view. That's our truest self. But if you follow this, you couldn't have civilization. So Freud's book, Civilization and Its Discontents, discontent is along these lines, right? So when Freud talks about things like coping mechanisms, okay, the coping mechanism is necessary because these principles are in an eternal battle and there's no solution. Now, wait for Marcuse's solution. But for Freud, there's no solution. There's no redemption. This is just a part of reality. Here it's kind of Gnostic, even in Freud. In reality itself is an intractable problem besides two principles that cannot be solved. So the term coping mechanisms from Freud comes about for how do you cope with this tension and this intractable problem that cannot be solved, right? You cope with it. You don't overcome it. You don't resolve it, etc. You just make do with the difficult situation. Marcuse. Society, therefore, must turn. This is what you do when you're following the reality principle. Society, therefore, must turn the instincts away from their immediate goal, pleasure, largely sexual pleasure, and subjugate them to the reality principle, which is the very principle of repression. So if you're as a parent not allowing your child to engage in the various sexual escapades they might want to join in, you're not, as Christians would say, helping shepherd your child in righteousness. You're oppressing them. And if you're trying to work out, I don't know the situation in Europe, in the States, why would the state educate government schools, public schools, why would they take a principal position not to tell parents if their child wants to go transition? Somebody had said, why would an educational system do that? Well, I'm not saying the educational folks are sitting around reading Marcuse, that's life too short to do too much of that, but the principles are floating around, right? Is the educational expert, I'm generalizing here for those kinds of that persons who would think this way, I'm helping that child become who they ought to be. I am helping that child to be free. And to be free, you must be rescued from the influence of your children, of your parents. Okay? So if Jean-Jacques Rousseau said this, man is born free and is everywhere in chains, the critical theorists are almost a little more radical. Man is born chained, right? And remains chained and is everywhere in chains. That's Stuart Jeffries again from his book, The Grand Hotel Abyss. So one thing we should keep in mind is the critical theorists are clearly not doing theology as we would do theology. So there's clearly a denial of any sort of pre-fall era, which more and more I find is so radically important in our theologizing. You must have a pre-fall era in history. And instead, it's kind of a Gnosticism, right? The problem is a part of the very structure of reality itself, this reality principle and pleasure principle in eternal combat. Okay? All right, let's move ahead. And let's go to the question of sin and the human dilemma. And here we look at Marcuse for a minute, his book, One Dimensional Man, 1964. I'm 59. I'm probably near the top age here. I don't know. Maybe some folks older than I am. I'm not old enough to remember this, but Marcuse was a real rock star. If you were in the 60s, there's a story of Marcuse going to a rock concert, and people begin to recognize him, and they start whispering, "He's here, he's here, he's arrived." And as the story's told, the crowd starts to part, almost like Moses, to allow him to get down to the front of the rock concert. So he wasn't just off in his office writing his books and avoiding the crowds. He was a rock star amongst the young persons of his day. So here's my summary of Marcuse, because here he's pretty difficult. In the present age, technological society had been so successful, wildly successful, that it had created the conditions under which the typical working man or woman no longer sees or grasps the myriad ways in which they are oppressed. In other words, the system, particularly the capitalist system, is so all-encompassing that you are in that system and do not even know you are oppressed. And culture plays a part of this, economics plays a part of this, traditional family plays a part of this, traditional churches play a part of this. Okay? All right. So again, there is a certain kind of freedom, and this is important to grasp. And Andrew Sandlin has coined a great, someone ever coined a phrase and you wish you had coined it because it's so great. He's got a phrase, libertarian Marxism. And that phrase may help, because what Sandlin's getting after there is there's a kind of freedom that Marcuse and others desire for persons, but the average person is so confused, so shaped by the culture industry, it's almost like a Matrix-y kind of novel, a Matrix kind of movie kind of thing, sci-fi kind of thing. You don't know you're living in under a false consciousness. You don't even know you're there. And so how do we help these people be free, right? Well, you need Marxism, right, to truly liberate someone, not just the poor person making, whatever, $1,000 a year or something, but the person who's making $50,000 a year or whatever, but who's still bound, right? It requires a kind of concentration or centralization of power. And here's what Marcuse writes. The goal of authentic self-determination by the individual, freedom, depends on effective social control over the production and distribution of the necessities of life in terms of the achieved level of culture, material, and intellectual. In other words, to have true freedom, there must be a radical centralization of power to rescue people from their oppression, even if they don't realize they are oppressed. Okay? All right, let's move ahead here for time's sake. Again, people are so conditioned that we do not realize our own dilemma. Now, the Christian can say that's true in a sense, right? So I didn't raise this question yesterday. Adam's presentation was so good. But even if Paul didn't have a guilty conscience, that might be a sign of his true captivity to sin, right? It's very possible in a Christian anthropology, a Christian view of sin, that a part of the problem of the unbeliever is they don't realize they have a problem, right? So the Christian at a theological level, we can speak similar terms, but not in the same context. But we're happy to say that the unbeliever we meet on the street doesn't realize their blindness, right? We're quite happy to say that. Let's shift to what's really key to Marcuse, and that is the centrality of sexual desire and pleasure. And again, I will not be crass or the like. So the path to true freedom really does require virtually unfettered sexual license and pleasure seeking. And this is my summary of I'm quoting here. the new direction of progress would depend completely on the opportunity to activate repressed or arrested organic biological needs. This is fascinating. To make the human body an instrument of pleasure rather than labor. Free gratification of man's instinctual needs is incompatible with civilized society. Renunciation and delay in satisfaction are the prerequisites of progress. If you're trying to work out, again, the line from Marcuse to today is there. I don't think everyone's sitting around reading Marcuse, but conceptually it's there. Why the zealous, virtually religious passion to make sure a traditional parent offers no restrictions on their child's sexual desires, right? Well, in a Marcusean world, it is because that is the path of true freedom. So if we get Marcuse, he's riffing on Freud, reality principle, sexual reality principle, pleasure principle. But here we get now to where Freud, Marcuse differs with Freud. And here's where things get even more perverse, to be frank. Where Freud thought that the struggle between the reality principle and the pleasure principle was eternal and could never be overcome, Marcuse thought there was a way for the pleasure principle to eventually win or conquer the reality principle. Or to put it slightly differently, there was a way for there to come into being a new kind of sexualized reality principle. If you read this, you think I'm being conspiratorial. Well, you read Eros and Civilization, and I think you'll see I'm being fair. So sexuality is by nature polymorphous, perverse. That's interesting, isn't it? By nature. As a society, the reality principle comes to dominate. Society condemns or marginalizes, quote, as perversions, practically all its, i.e. the sex instincts, manifestations which do not serve or prepare for the procreative function. Hold on to your hats, because what he's going to say is there's much more pleasure and freedom and self-realization to be had in sexual experiences which are not procreative. Because to engage in sexual experiences which are procreative is to advance the patriarchy. I mean, it has its own inner perverse logic, right? The perversions thus, he calls them perversions, that's not I, that's he. The perversions thus express rebellion against the subjugation of sexuality under the order of procreation and against the institutions which guarantee this order. And those institutions are clearly traditional churches and traditional families. So if you're trying to work out why the word fascist in current discourse? Why is the traditional family fascist? Well, Adorno and his co-editors have this book about this thick, you may have seen on the shelves, children, The Authoritarian Personality by Adorno. The goal is to stop fascism/Nazism. How do you do that? You must root out and find any proclivity like traditional churches or traditional families, because there's a personality there which will inhibit full sexual exploration, and that is by definition fascist. Okay? If you've seen or read Philip K. Dick's The Minority Report, either the short story or the film, precogs, persons who can see people committing crimes before they commit them. This is Philip K. Dick's sci-fi stuff. How do we root out fascism before it emerges? Well, you all are suspect, no doubt. And if you're a complementarian, again, you're more suspect, right? And if you believe in, you know, headship of the father, etc., That's all the authoritarian personality, which must be stopped to stop the rise of the next Hitler. That's the logic, right? That's the logic of critical theory. Let me talk about redemption. Let me talk about the answer that I'm against. So again, the goal is, what is the nature of reality or creation? What is sin? And what's the solution? That's how I'm analyzing critical theory. I'm going to stay with Marcuse mainly. So sexuality is central to the problem, and hence it's central to the solution. I'm going to bypass the technology discussion for a second. Here's what he says. All liberation proposes a revolution, an upheaval in the order of instincts and needs, a new reality principle. Very interesting. So the Marxists, as you know, the goal is not to understand the world, but to change it. And this is that Marxist principle with a vengeance, probably more radical than Marx, because Marcuse is saying he wants to change the metaphysical structure of the universe and to sexualize it, because that's the path to true freedom. So they'll say they're not for metaphysics. They associate that with conservative, traditional, Greek-y stuff, but they've, by all no doubt, have their own metaphysic. They're actually wanting to create virtually a new metaphysical reality. So this new reality principle, this redemption, is sexually centered. What is needed? So again, Freud, pleasure principle, reality principle, eternal combat. Marcuse says Freud missed it. What we need is, you could say it different ways, the pleasure principle, or we might say the victory of the pleasure principle. You might say the pleasure principle becomes the new reality principle. In other words, all reality must be sexualized. Now, in the U.S., when a group chants, we're here, what's the chant? We're here, we're gay, what's that? We're here, we're queer, we're coming for your children, right? You could think that's just a one-off weird thing. And again, I don't think these people are sitting around reading Marcuse necessarily, but someone was. And ideas have consequences in a funny way, right? And reality must be sexualized. He even says this, reason must be sexualized. Because reason is also seen as, reason associated with the reality principle is seen as resisting the pleasure principle, right? So how do you have the pleasure principle become victorious? Well, you don't just beat reason, you sexualize reason. I mean, it's, again, I'm not making this up. This is all in the, I'll give you my notes if you want to see chapter and verse here. All right. So Marcuse says, we shall presently try to show that it would affect, this revolution, that it would affect the very structure of the psyche. After the alter the balance between eros, more or less the pleasure principle, and thanatos, death, more or less the reality principle, reactivate tabooed realms of gratification, sexually, and pacify the conservative tendencies of the instinct. A new basic experience of being would change the human existence in its entirety. Now, so that Leo doesn't have to pull me off the stage, I'm going to move to my conclusion. But in short, through more and more virtually unfettered sexual experience, there can be a literal reshaping of the human psyche, a altering of human consciousness. So the language of raising consciousness, it's not neutral language, is how you're going to bring about this revolution. And all you silly folks are standing in the way, whether you know it or not, right? That's how the critical theorists would view us, okay? All right, let me move to, there's so much more I want to say. Let me move to my conclusion. Let me offer a Christian response. I have benefited from certain people like James Lindsay, an American, actually an atheist, he may be an agnostic now, who has written some very fun things on critical theory. But his answer to critical theory is, hey, we need the Enlightenment, right? And so I think the Christian can say, I'll take my friends where I can get them, and I'll take what's good in the Enlightenment. But that can't be the whole answer for a Christian, okay, as far as I'm concerned. So I want to suggest the contours of a Christian response. Number one, and I'll treat each under the three issues of creation, sin, redemption. Under creation and reality, the Christian is going to say, of course, there is a pre-fall and a post-fall era that's totally lost in critical theory. It is Gnostic. Things are bad by nature, okay? On work, work is a good reality in pre-fall. So what somehow I deleted here is Genesis 1, 26 and following, dominion mandate, work. Genesis 2, 15, work and keep the garden. Those are good things, right? Those are proper things, central to human being, not a something that combats being truly free and et cetera, okay? But also we should think about on culture, civilization, the goodness of communities, civilization, and institutions. So again, whatever my strengths and weaknesses as a father, my task was to raise my children in the discipline and instruction of the Lord. And Christians, we need to decide, are our children just there for a few years and we try not to interfere, then let them go? Or is our mandate to raise them in the discipline and instruction of the Lord? Is that something that's good for our children, ideally, right? You can ask my children my weaknesses and sins, but not now, but that's the goal, right? That's the command of Scripture. But the church also, right? The church is an institution which does shape us, and it's a good thing. It shouldn't hamper me becoming the person I ought to become, right? I need good pastors, right? I need to take the Lord's Supper. I need to be baptized, right? I need someone to rebuke me. You need someone to challenge, rebuke, edify you. You've got gifts. You can only become the person you really ought to be if you're involved meaningfully in a church, okay? And of course, passages like this, bad company ruins morals. But also something from Van Til, and it's either Why I Believe or My Credo, one of those great short essays or dialogues he writes, is his interlocutor says, oh, Van Til, you are conditioned. You're not really free, you're conditioned. And Van Til gives a very typical Van Tilian response. He says, yep, I am conditioned. I was raised by mom and dad in a Christian home. I was raised in a Christian church, given Christian schooling, and that's conditioned me. But that's not a bad thing. And he says, and by the way, you're conditioned too, right? If you're raised thinking like an atheist, thinking like an unbeliever, you've been conditioned to be an unbeliever. So the conditioning we give each other as people, it can be bad, right? There's a higher judgment for teachers, James 3. But conditioning, in its ultimate sense, doesn't need to be a bad thing. On sin, my short take, for the critical theorists, they're not critical enough. For the critical theorist, this is me summarizing, the problem is with reality itself, essentially Gnostic. There's a denial of personal responsibility, whereas for Christians, the problem is here, right, in the human heart. So this great Romans 1, right? Romans 1 doesn't say that the problem's outside of me, but that I am at some level willfully and I'm responsible for my own epistemological self-deception. So G.K. Chesterton was, a number of folks were asked to write an essay for a British newspaper answering the question, what is wrong with the world? And Chesterton's classic response, dear sirs, I am, right? The problem is here. It took me a while to see this, but the critical theorists are, Gnostic in the sense, and it's somewhat Pelagian almost, radical Pelagian. The problem's not here. The problem's out there. I'm the innocent victim in a cog, right? So that's why you have to change the system, right? The problem's not in the human heart. The problem's not rebellion, et cetera. On redemption, Marcuse's new reality principle, transformed person, you could see it as a kind of perversion of the Christian concept of new birth or new creation. The Christian is not a conservative simply in the sense that things get better slowly or something. The Christian is one who's a radical in one sense and says, we need a new birth, a new creation. So we agree what we need is radical, right? But it's not through, for the critical theorists from Marcuse, it's almost redemption through sexual intent, sexual pleasure. It is perverse. The Bible gives a quite different view. And again, while the problem is out there for critical theory, the solution is in here, right? Critical theory is essentially Pelagian at its best, okay? So in other words, for the critical theorist, the problem is the system, where the solution is I and my radical sexual freedom. The hope for, now this is what's, I think, perverse, the hope for reality principle is a further plunging into and sinking into sin rather than a turning from sin. There is no repentance in critical theory, and there's no real redemptive hope in critical theory.